My place in tech changes every day, but I don't fear the future because I'm with the leader, Pluralsight. Their online learning platform has the hands-on, expert-led courses I need to master new tech skills and create bigger impacts so I can learn quickly and stay ahead. With Pluralsight, I don't fear what's next. I embrace it. Tap in at Pluralsight.com and see for yourself.
This is a Hattrick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
The Coldest Shift. Episode 3. The JCR.
Life on a ship. I've just Googled the wrong ship. I can tell you about the James Cook.
What ship is that? So here's my room.
So, the James Clark Ross.
It's got a view of a lifeboat out the window, which is always very reassuring.
Were you at maximum capacity then?
We were absolutely full to the brim. Absolutely full to the brim.
How many people was that on the James Clark Ross?
Oh, I'd have to check, but I think it was near 70.
Yeah.
I suddenly realised the luxury of being ship's crew, because I had my own cabin, which was very nice.
My room is probably 2.5 metres wide, so it's fairly wide. Probably about 2.5 metres deep as well. It's got a nice carpet.
My own shower, very nice.
And I learned a valuable lesson in here this morning, that the curtain likes to hug you when you're in the shower, so you end up showering with a curtain in your face.
And then these FIDs that have just had a hotel room to themselves for 2 weeks, now we're sharing 4 to a room.
Mm. Yeah, clothes hanging up. And above that, I have a little fold-out cupboard there with my life jacket and my immersion suit for emergency. In here, I've got a little fridge. Unfortunately, I've got nothing to go in the fridge, but I like the sentiment. Some shelves above, got a book. What have I got? The Lonely Planet Guide to Antarctica, my diary, a couple of medical books, my roll-up piano, obviously essential. So I'm slowly working my way around, trying to work out where's where. And it's funny, when everyone's at work, the ship is ghostly quiet because everyone's down in the bellows doing engineering or whatever. So you can wander around the ship and not see anyone for quite a while.
For me, it was quite a nerve-wracking time because I hadn't really spent much time on the ship. So you've been quite lucky. You've spent quite a lot of time on the Sir David Attenborough. So I spent a whole week working probably 12-hour days just trying to make sure before we left Harwich I had everything I needed, going through every single cupboard in the hospital, working out what was where.
Know what you've got. It's very different to being in a hospital.
Then the weirdest thing happened, right? So we're on this ship. We kind of vaguely got to know each other. There's about 30 of us. It's very quiet in the evenings. We play a bit of darts. We have a glass of wine, a beer, whatever. And then all of a sudden, the FIDs arrived.
The outsiders.
There's about, I don't know, 40, 45 of them. And the excitement of them was just unbearable for about 24 hours. And this very quiet ship turned into this party boat,
right,
of people so excited to go down south, which I was, but not quite that noisy.
I bumped into the captain on the stairs and I felt duty bound to follow him because he said he was going for dinner. So I followed him into the sort of officer's saloon for dinner, and the noise was incredibly loud. Having spent 2 weeks in the hotel room on my own and then a week on a ship with 20 other people, suddenly to walk into a room with 44 people was sensory overload. I had to make my excuses and tell the captain I had to go and get something from my room, and I went back and ate in the crew mess where there was 6 of us and it was much more manageable. I mean, they're lovely, but after all that time with not many people, I've sort of forgotten how to deal with lots of people, which was really interesting.
An icebreaker, yeah. Reinforced front to get through the thickest of.
The starboard side's the best side.
Covering in is on point.
The other thing I've been looking out for today is these FIDs getting seasick. So I've given varying amounts of advice out to the people that look a bit quiet or a bit queasy. And there was a dare from one of the ship's crew, I shan't name who, to spread the rumour that sniffing a potato cures seasickness. There's a lot of psychology behind seasickness, and then any placebo will work. I'm not sure if the chef wants all these people going down to the kitchen asking for his potatoes. So The next port of call is South Georgia, King Edward Point in the subantarctic region, which is an exciting sentence to say.
So I decided I was going to use this as an opportunity to be very well behaved. So I didn't drink any alcohol when we were away for lots of different reasons. One, you're paid to be there. That's your job. And you wouldn't drink normally when you're doing your job. One would hope. You are the doctor and you're fairly remote. And if something were to happen and you had a hangover or you had a little bit of clouded judgment, then it would just be unforgivable. And also it was a really good excuse to be teetotal. So I went teetotal apart from a few special occasions, notably my birthday. I got into a few other good habits. So my day typically started, and this is going to horrify you, around about 5:45 in the morning. So roll your eyes. And I would go down to the gym, so trot along the hospital, go down 2 flights of stairs, which when your eyes are mostly still closed because it's so early in the morning was always a little bit hairy. And at the bottom there was a gym, and one of the deck crew and I, we did a spinning class every morning at 6.
We were spinning and one of the other guys saw a whale out to sea. I couldn't see anything at all. There was just so much sweat in my face.
And it was just the best feeling. So you come up the stairs with that smug of just an exercise feeling that we all get. And you're stood on the deck drinking a coffee in the middle of the ocean.
Do you need to let out a safety announcement? The sun is out, the gingers need to go in. Can I say the same about the Scottish?
From there, I'd probably go and have some breakfast, and there was a period of time where we had some fresh fruit. That didn't last very long at all.
We're nearly in Spanish water. We're like a good half the way across this.
And then I would normally run the hospital as like a drop-in clinic, so I tried to run it between sort of 8 a.m. and midday. And I'm going to be honest, I didn't have patients every day, but I always had visitors, so there'd be a constant stream of people coming down.
One of them just came in here to sound off about his morning.
How are you? Do you want a cup of coffee?
Just sat down, sounded off, and then left. And it was lovely.
And it was a mixture of FIDs, who, for some of them, it was their first time away from home. Some of them, they're old hats. They've just come to meet the new doctor.
It was really very nice.
But also there was a few crew that would come down to mumble about that bit of machinery that wasn't working, or my wife at home is moaning about this, or whatever. So I always had visitors. The only way to know people aren't okay is to know what they are like when they're okay. So I was really keen to get round the crew and just get to know them.
What's if somebody second comes in?
Well, then we abandon ship, don't we?
Well,
lifeboat's just there.
So there was only 4 girls that were crew on board, and one of them was called Gail. She is the second mate, and she's this lovely Scottish lady who has a real passion for all things penguin.
Is she going to be on the SDA?
She will be.
Ah, oh, brilliant.
You're going to have a lovely time.
So what I want to know, Gail, is a little bit about you. How did you hear about Baz?
I've always known about Baz. Baz is like the dream job when you work.
Is it?
Yeah.
What did you work on before?
Before I worked offshore construction, and I worked for the lighthouse board in Scotland, basically covered.
So you literally put all the safety stuff in the sea so we know where we're going.
Yeah.
That's
like,
really cool.
Lighthouses, playing with helicopters.
Why is Baz the people to work for? What's so great?
Because they go to Antarctica and they go to the Arctic.
Is that the ultimate for a seafarer, is it?
I guess it depends what floats your boat, as it were.
So we did that.
Yeah,
very
totally
good.
Sorry.
So how long have you worked for Baz for?
Just under 2 years.
Okay. Now, I don't really get the structure of the hierarchy of the ship. Can you just run through that for me? So top dog is
captain. Yep, captain, old man. He's a boss. He's our mighty leader. He's the dad of the ship, I guess. But like,
he's lovely as well.
Sometimes I mean dad, if he has to be. Yeah.
Rather than having fear, I feel like he's got more of the disappointment thing.
Oh yeah.
So if I do something wrong, I'm more scared that he'll be disappointed than angry.
Yeah, that's the way it should be. Yeah. captain at the top. And we've got a chief officer who basically does like the cargo loading. He's like the deck department head, like line manager, I guess. You put
okay.
That. So captain, chief mate, then we've got second mate, navigation, pretty much. So taking care of charts, all the bridge equipment.
Who's next?
That was fun. Then we've got third mates. We've got two. One too many, you might say.
Is that normal to have two?
It can be. Sometimes I've worked on ships, we have 2 second mates. Or you can have ships where you've got 2 chief mates. It all very much depends.
That's a bit tense.
So yeah, we've got two. So they're kind of life-saving appliances and firefighting appliances is like their main. So on here, myself and the 2 third mates do watches. So we're off to the watch. So we do like navigation, looking out the window, make sure we don't hit anything. That's like day-to-day navigation as opposed to like my job where I'm like passage planning. And then going down the deck department, you've got like the bosun, who's like, I guess like a sergeant in the army is maybe a way to describe that. So
okay.
Like he's a rating, but he's also kind of like the kind of senior guy on deck, if you like. On here we've got a chippy or a bosun's mate, which traditionally is like the ship's carpenter.
Okay.
But again, he's like stepped in from bosun, so like he would take care of certain things. He does things like tank soundings on here. kind of like the ship's plumber, carpenter, kind of. Like, that's a bit traditional.
He's like the handyman.
Yeah, kind of. Okay. So you sit down from the bosun if you like. Then we've got our ABs, so able seamen. So, like, I guess maybe deckhands would be kind of layman's way of putting that. So they do things like maintenance on the ship, mooring up the ship, driving boats, lowering boats, seamanship, look out on the bridge, might steer if they have to.
That's cool.
And then we've got an ordinary seaman on board at the moment, which is about unusual. So he's going to be an AB when he grows up, I guess, if that's the way to put it. So he's a pretty qualified guy already, but he's kind of on deck at the moment, so that's pretty cool. He's really interested in things. It's nice to have people on watch. So he's like learning to steer, he's learning to do a lot of the kind of traditional roles and rope work and things. So
that's cool.
It's really nice.
And then you've got the engineers.
Yeah, engineers. We don't want to talk about them. Cause oil and water. I've always gone with engineers and I don't know why. Maybe because I don't have to deal with them or work with them. Maybe that's where it is. But we also we've got chief engineer, we've got second engineer, third engineer, fourth engineer. We've got two motormen, so they're kind of like ratings. So they do a lot of things like greasing and general works.
I was going to say, what's the difference between a motorman and an engineer?
Watermen are ratings, really, so it doesn't mean they're not technical. I'd say one of our watermen's more like a fitter, so he's probably better on like welding, fitting things. So yeah, so that's kind of what they're like. They might help with greasing and keeping the place clean, like they assist the engineers kind of thing.
Okay.
We need to speak to them. I'm just like,
yeah, no, it's fine.
It's a foreign world down here. I think back in the day you'd have this kind of like thing where sort of the deck department would like take pride in not knowing about the engine room, but that's bad practice. Like, you should be down there, you should know what you've got down there, you should know what equipment you've got down there, you should know what you're playing with, how it works.
How many times have you been to the Antarctic?
I've been 2 times to the Antarctic, so I did a science, we call it cruises, but a science cruise down there. So we took a bunch of scientists.
That sounds wonderful. It sounds like everyone's laid on deck chairs drinking mojitos.
If only they had been. They were such a lovely bunch. Like, some of the scientists are really, really, really nice people. Some of them are very crazy people, they're very like focused, but yeah, no, they're a lovely bunch.
Gail's other job on the ship is to make sure that we don't have any stowaways. Now, I don't mean people, I mean animals. They take biosecurity very seriously down in the Antarctic, so by that I mean you can't take any soil that doesn't belong there, seeds that doesn't belong there, and specifically any animals. So once a week she has to go around the entire ship looking for mice.
Great job.
I don't think she'd describe that as great. She has to go down some quite small tunnels into different holds of the ship just to check there still aren't any mice on board.
It's a really old-fashioned ship, isn't it?
Yeah, she's really traditional. She's lovely. She's like proper merchant navy.
Tell me about some of the weird traditions that you have.
So you still have crew and officers' mess. We still have like a saloon where you get served dinner.
It's table service on a ship in the middle of the ocean.
It's pretty unusual in this day and age, and that's what it would have been back in the day. I just think the way, because it's like a lot of British, although shipping's always international and always will be kind of international, but it's very much a British ship, so even things like the flags we fly, we do things properly on here. When we're in port, like, flags up at sunrise and then down at sunset, it's like probably a lot of people don't bother with that anymore, but we still do, we're like proper, and that's nice. And I think it's like, you can be like, oh, why do you bother with these old traditions? Because this was it, like, traditions, peer pressure from the dead. But you should enjoy these things while they're about, because that's, embrace it while you've got it, because it's going to change, and it's like the futures, or even just daft things, like people call things what they should be called on here. It's like, I think because...
It's not the ceiling, is it?
No, it's not the ceiling. I always get very upset. I forgive the scientists, because they don't know. That's all right. We've got our ceiling, our deckhead, our bulkhead instead of our walls, our decks. Floor is the one that really drives me mad, because a floor is a vertical structure on a ship, so that I'm always like, no. That's just fundamentally wrong on all levels.
What?
Oh, you can take it off. Up on the bow, watching dolphins jump across the bow of our ship as we started going through the Bay of Biscay. And there was maybe 20 dolphins jumping in, doing belly flops all across the bow wave.
Permission to come on the bridge, whatever.
And I went up to the bridge and said to one of the girls who's on the bridge there, oh man, there's loads of dolphins down there. And she's like, oh, honestly, if you think this is dolphins, you wait.
I think some of the fids are quite scared of you because you keep correcting them.
Yeah, I think it's the accent. They're terrified of me because I'm Scottish.
It was when one of them said, quick, there's dolphins off the starboard side, and then pointed to port.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know where you mean.
Yeah. What? Where are the dolphins?
Which port do you mean?
Yeah. It's really nice when they get excited about the... I think it's like, we take all these things for granted because, this is what we do for a living. It's kind of normal, and it's still nice to see those things. Like, you don't want to get too jaded, but it's really nice when you get people on who are, like, super enthusiastic.
Fish.
Mm.
You see them? A big flying fish.
Oh, yeah.
Right at the top of the ship, outside, there was a place called the Monkey Deck, which is where a lot of the scientific equipment existed. So it was doing meteorology stuff, air temperatures, wind temperatures, all that sort of stuff. Nadia and Ryan, the two marine biologists, I can only describe as them living up there. I don't think they spend any other time anywhere else other than up on the Monkey Deck.
So, Nadia.
So, Rachel.
Oh, we started.
I think you're the most excited person on the ship.
Well, Rachel, I'm excited
about... Stop being formal.
Okay. Nadia was one of the people I met on board. She was fresh out of university, having done a marine biology degree down in Plymouth. And she had the most enigmatic passion for algae, wow, seaweed and weird jellyfish. They were doing this really incredible project and they were logging every bit of marine wildlife that they saw. You could shout whale and just see how fast Nadia would run.
We're looking, there's five of us that are part of this daily observations. I mean, you can be on our team, but the thing is, you're always in the surgery doing some really fun x-rays of flying fish.
Tell me, what's your brief when you're in the Antarctic?
Yeah, so the position I applied for.
You sound like you're a spy.
Oh, I am actually a spy.
You'd
in my
be a
other life.
Spy.
Would I?
Yeah.
Am I not very discreet?
You talk too fast.
Talk too fast?
Yeah.
Oh, no, but that's how I obtain so much information because I just. Actually, you say this. I've already killed three people in Assassin.
Have you ever played Assassins?
No.
Oh, excellent game.
How long did this game last?
I think it may still be going on.
Tell me about your brief down south, secret agent.
My brief down south. The project that I'll be doing at Rothera is investigating the growth rate of benthic species. So that's species that live on the bottom of the seafloor.
Okay.
So we really want to get environmental or field growth rates so we can see how quickly they're growing and how this growth rate changes between summer and winter. So I'll also be supplementing this with dietary analyses. So I'll look at their stomach contents.
This is the cutting the starfish in half.
It is, and the sea cucumbers, it is. Because in order to understand what they eat, we need to dissect their stomachs. And then you can look at, under a high-powered microscope, electron scanning microscope, you can look at their different food sources, such as diatoms and organic matter content.
So hang a minute, so tell me about it. So you're going to get up, you're going to go dive into the bottom of the ocean.
You're
going to pick up a cucumber and a starfish.
And some other species, other invertebrates, some worms and some clams. I'm not really going to pick them up. So I'll collect the species initially.
Yeah.
Then I'll build an in situ, so that means in the environment, enclosure to keep the species in the sediment.
Okay, but on land?
But in the sea, no. So I'll collect the species and then I'll build this enclosure under the water. Because the thing is, we've got lots of information from laboratory studies, but it's not reflective of what's happening in the environment.
Because
they need to have the whole food web. They need to have all the prey that they're eating.
They need to experience the nutrients,
things that we can partially replicate in the laboratory but not properly. So field measurements are super hard to get, but being in such a unique place as Antarctica, they want to have as many real life, as we say, observations.
Tell me about the bit where you cut the starfish in half and burn them.
So this is starfish lady, right? So well, it's actually with
Have you lied to me?
No, I actually said it was sea cucumbers. So it's the sea cucumbers that are going into a muffle furnace. So we burn sea cucumbers.
When you say muffle furnace, does that mean you can't hear their screams?
Exactly. It's at like 400 degrees plus. So you weigh the sea cucumbers before they're burnt.
Yeah.
And then you weigh the ash.
Right.
And the difference between the starting mass and the ash is the ash-free dry weight.
Okay.
So essentially the organic matter content burns away and you can see how much carbon those organisms represent. You can kind of then map their position in the food chain.
So you're going to do that between summer and winter?
Between summer and winter and autumn and spring. Those seasons are not as defined in Antarctica, but we'll be doing 4 yearly collections. So we can really see the trends when the growth rate is changing most at like what point of the summer and most point of the winter. But it's going to be very logistically challenging, Rachel, because in order to get statistically sound data, you need a lot of replication. So we're going to have to set up many different enclosures with many different species to really draw conclusions that are representative of the population.
Are you going to cut the starfish in half and burn them as well?
So no, with the starfish, I'm going to measure their growth rates and I'm also going to measure their respiration. So I'll put them in jars for
a certain
period.
How do you know? How can you count?
They're massive predators. So it's really interesting. So you put them in a jar of seawater in a sealed tight jar, and you measure the oxygen concentration before the respiration incubation. You leave them to incubate for about an hour or two, depending on how quickly they breathe.
after the 2 hours, you open the jar and you sample the water, and then the change in oxygen concentration is how much oxygen they've used. So that equates to their respiration. They are really, really ferocious predators.
Are they?
They are.
What do they eat?
They eat. They're detritus.
You're about to tell me they've got beaks.
No, they don't have beaks. Not as such, but they do have an opening cavity where they can eat. Like, they can eat parts of anemones, different sources of organic matter, some clams, some whelks.
So you're going to measure that between the seasons as best you can. What do you do with that information? What does that tell you?
So that feeds into long-term studies about understanding how Antarctic species are changing and responding to their environment. So we can compare this growth data with previous measurements of growth data and see, for example, is the temperature affecting growth rates? And if we get warmer summers and increasingly warmer winters as well, less ice cover, how will their growth rates be affected, and how will the whole functioning of benthic ecosystems change?
Okay. So by measuring climate change?
Lots of the basic information about how communities are responding need parameters such as growth and respiration. So it's kind of getting an idea of the functioning of these ecosystems, so that can be then input or compared to past data and input into climate models to, if there was certain degrees of temperature of warming, how would that affect these communities?
What's your favourite marine mammal? I can't even say it, marine mammal.
Yeah, my favourite marine mammal, orcas. So in Antarctica, there's three different types of killer whales, and one killer whale species ecotype specialises on just eating fish. The other eats just marine mammals, and the other eats penguins. So they communicate in different ways to be able to target their prey, and they don't compete because their diets don't overlap.
I see. Yeah. So like, for a marine biologist, this is like the ultimate dream, going to the Antarctic.
It is, Rachel. It's such a unique place.
And you're only, what, 12?
I am 23.
So going there at the age of 23, the pinnacle of your career is in your 20s. What do you do after this?
Well, after that, I take an early retirement. And I go and sail the seas.
Do you just
And I just watch the
leave?
Flying fish.
I keep getting distracted by them because they're so weird.
So there's so many flying fish that keep jumping off the sides of the boat. And now we've just seen one that's just popped into the water. So there's 67 different species of flying fish that are mostly distributed around the tropics. And they've evolved this really unique adaptation in that they've got wings, and it is to evade predators. But as the boat's passing through their territory in areas where they're resting at the surface, we're disturbing them and they're flying.
You know, typically now we're talking about, oh, there they are.
Yeah.
I can see them.
And sometimes there's groups of 20, and it's really amazing. So the average distance is 50 metres.
50 metres?
50 metres.
Oh, gosh, that is really far to fly, let alone as a fish.
Yes, and some can even fly up to 200 metres.
Oh, my God. It's so weird. It sounds like they're tap dancing on the water. You can hear them, like, dancing across.
The wildlife on our trip was just incredible, and something I learned a huge amount about. Turns out the scientists don't like it if you call all birds seagulls. We saw a huge amount of wildlife, and the incredible thing was, because there were so many knowledgeable people around, not just the scientists, but the crew that had been south before as well, that every bird, every animal, every whale that you saw, someone had a really interesting fact about them. First of all was the pig. We had a pig on board.
A live pig?
No. So we were going to hog roast in the evening on the afterdeck. And so they had a pig specially. Being the creative Blue Peter wannabe, I decided this was a really good opportunity to teach the first aid team how to suture.
Dog school.
Dog school.
Right, so this is part of your first aid training. In your pack, you'll get a little dish that contains tweezers.
Essentially, the chefs wanted to stuff these pigs with some beautiful herbs, some lemons, some limes. Don't forget, we had fresh fruit at the time. And I happened to loiter on purpose when they were doing this with a suturing kit. And I said to them, rather than just sew it back together, would you like to learn how to suture?
What's that ball string? See, that's meat string.
And I think it was really good because we sort of shared and bonded a little bit there as well, because I think they thought, well, she knows I'm doing a really good job, and I thought, well, I know they're doing a really good job.
And were they part of your medical assistant team?
Yeah, so on board, everyone falls into a team if there's an emergency. So some people form the fire team, some people form the bridge team, and you get a medical team, which consists of essentially three of the catering team. Now, in reality, probably they wouldn't need to suture unless something had happened to me. But if I needed suturing, I would have been more than happy for those chaps to suture me based on how good that pig was stuffed.
I'm very pleased to hear that I have chefs on my medical assistant team.
So my mum has decided that the best way to remind me that she exists is to provide a weekly present, which was a really lovely idea. Obviously week one being the one where we left, which was a lovely card and a lovely necklace. And week two was a pillowcase with maybe 20 pictures of my friends, my family, our dog, my flat, the beach, that kind of stuff. And it's really lovely. So we've gone across the Bay of Biscay without too much trouble. It's slightly too hot during the day now, and the deck crew have built a swimming pool on the aft deck out of disused pallets and some big tarpaulin. It sits there as a beautiful little sun trap. Being doctor, however, I kind of have to say that they have to empty the water each day, so it's just seawater they pump in, but I just don't want anyone going down with anything, having quarantined for 2 weeks to then catch something in a man-made swimming pool halfway across Portugal would be a disaster. In other news, we tested out the x-ray machine. So we've got x-ray facility for both dental pictures and other pictures. Now, the dental x-ray was reasonably straightforward to use, and we spent a lot of time with a dentist before coming to the Antarctic. So today we did some plain film x-rays. So if something happens and someone falls over, breaks their arm, blah, 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 you need to confirm it with an x-ray. So the facilities here really are quite old school, and in that way, I mean, exciting, really.
Is there such thing as a good and bad x-ray? Is it just an x-ray?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a big difference, especially clinically. You get like really underexposed ones, you can't see anything.
Okay.
And you get like really dark ones, or ones that are badly positioned or rotated.
And then you get a really sassy doctor saying that's awful.
Yeah.
Somehow I let it slip in the bar that I was going to test the x-ray machine the next day. The amount of people that asked for an x-ray of their hand, foot, face, head, neck was unbearable. Just for your record, Jen, it is illegal to x-ray a person that doesn't need an x-ray. The GMC don't look very kindly on it.
X-ray.
Excellent.
Good
job.
Ooh,
you feel the tension. So much tension.
So essentially, we offered it to the floor as to what people wanted x-raying that weren't body parts.
So we picked a few items to x-ray. So we lined up my scissors,
cameras, radios, iPods,
toothbrush,
spoons, syringes, random items.
I'm recording this event, by the way, in case anyone wondered.
I did that with Clara, the doctor that was going down to Rotherham.
Hello, Rachel, it's recording.
Do you want another apron?
Yes, please. Sorry. It's
then we had to take the film into the dark room, which is in the hospital, under red light, open it up.
And the smells from the chemicals were pretty exciting. It felt like I was back in the 1920s doing it the old-fashioned way.
You have to put it into the developer for 2-3 minutes, then into the stop bath, and then into the fixer for 2 or 3 minutes, and then back into the stop bath and hang it up.
Whoa, that's awesome!
And we are absolutely chuffed with our results.
Put it up against the light box.
That's my camera!
That's my EpiPen. That's my Kindle.
Probably my most proud moment so far.
Look at the detail on the circuit board.
In the evening, we were doing a pub quiz. All of a sudden, we had a phone call to the bar saying that there was some bioluminescent algae coming out the stern of the boat. So we put down our beer.
That's never a phone call you expect to receive.
And we all trotted down to the aft end of the boat. Bearing in mind, we're somewhere north of the tropics at the time. It's pitch black on the aft deck because if you have lights on, the birds will fly into the ship and end their lives quite quickly. So we had to very carefully stumble to the aft end of the ship. I'm not going to lie to you. I spent a little bit of time trying to work out if they were having me on. It took my eyes a little while to realise that at the back of the boat, where the propellers were kicking up the water, it was kicking up this algae.
Wow.
And it was just this beautiful, long, blue-green trail behind us going miles off into the distance.
That's incredible.
Where these really excited scientists and FIDs had been so noisy in the bar, they were completely silent.
The Coldest Shift is presented by Dr. Rachel Varnum and Dr. Jenna Plank. The series is produced by Rachel Varnum and John Wakefield. The executive producers are Claire Broughton and Laura Varnum. The studio engineer was Alex O'Donovan. With thanks to the British Antarctic Survey and the British Antarctic Survey Medical Unit. Find out more about their crucial work at bas.ac.uk. Nadia Frontier now presents the British Antarctic Survey's official podcast, Ice World. Look out for it on all podcast platforms.
I chose Stick of the Dump by Clive King.
I've chosen Little Women by Louisa May Alcott.
I have chosen the book When Hitler Stole Pink Rabbit.
I have chosen My Friend Flicker.
Danny, Champion of the World.
The Seven Crystal Balls.
The Iron Man.
Claudine at St. Clair's.
The Guinness Book of Records.
I chose Ballyshoes.
And then I came across in a school library a copy of Treasure Island. I was terrified.
I'm Janet Ellis, and each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy.
It's not at all as I remember it.
This is a celebration of reading.
I ended up reading it to my mum at home every night.
Because who doesn't still secretly check under the bed for monsters?
I knew that it was true.
Harbour secret desires to run off to the circus.
Riding like the wind into the purple hills. It really captured my imagination.
Twice Upon a Time. Follow us on Instagram at @TwiceUponPod for updates and guest news.
I want to read this book again and again and again and again and again.
Twice Upon a Time is a Hat Trick podcast.